Peter B. Collins News and Comment. It's Friday, March 20, 2020. Did I get all the 20s in there? And as we're all hunkered down, with increasing restrictions being announced in many locations across the country, I think we're all feeling pretty OCD right now. Now, I make no fun of people who have obsessive compulsive disorder. It can be a very difficult thing. It's treated now with medications. But if you know anyone who has tangled with OCD, they're phobic of germs and surfaces. They wash their hands, sometimes to the point of bloodying their hands because they're so compulsive about it. And I think right now we're all feeling a bit OCD. Yesterday I paid some bills, put stamps on it, and went to a blue mailbox and dropped them off. And I carried a piece of Kleenex with me to cover the handle of the mailbox as I deposited the envelopes. And because this virus is invisible, people can carry it without having symptoms, without knowing. We have to now treat every surface, every person we encounter, as a risk to our ongoing health. And it probably does have some benefits. I've tried to stop touching my face. I mean, I often pull on my beard and touch my mustache and, you know, clean out the corner of my eyes. And every time I do that now, I'm thinking, uh-oh. So last night, California Governor Gavin Newsom made the right call. He issued a statewide order. There's some 40 million people now here in the Golden State. And we are all confined to our quarters. And as I mentioned the other day, I'm very fortunate and I feel grateful that I have quarters. Mine are pretty nice. I'll just concede that. I've got heat. I've got food. I've got a loving partner. I value my dog Chloe at a time like this more than ever. But Newsom has some calculations that if we don't take these actions over the next 8 weeks, 56% of Californians, about 25 million people, could be infected. So they've expanded the shutdown of retail, indoor malls, most corporate offices. So what we have are banks, grocery stores, pharmacies, laundromats. The automated car wash down the street is still operating. And some people are sneaking by. There is no real enforcement. We're not under martial law. But yesterday here in Marin County, it was kind of nice out. And the cops were called to two different golf courses to tell them to put their clubs away and go home. So it's being done in a, I think, fairly gentle manner. And I hope that it has an effect in, as we're all know, all hearing these days, we got to flatten that curve. So here is our daily COVID-19 news update, edited by Linda Lewis. And thanks to Linda for all her hard work on this. We now have a total of 15,219 coronavirus cases in the United States reported. But because we are still catching up on the availability of testing, what we can very surely conclude is that that number is frightfully low. There are 201 deaths reported nationwide. Internationally, 10,316 people dead so far. In Italy, the death toll upwards of 4,000 now. 1,400 deaths in Iran, just over 1,000 in Spain, 372 in France. The worldwide case total is over 200,000. The World Health Organization did a little math. They said it took 3 months to reach the first 100,000 confirmed cases and 12 days to reach the next 100,000. Now, like so many things, the figures do reflect increased testing, which indicates that it is widespread even before people develop symptoms. So the State Department has told Americans they've moved the travel advisory to level 4. American citizens abroad should return home or stay in place. And they are strongly advising people not to travel unless absolutely necessary. And Linda, who's based in Texas, has a local report there. Fort Worth police will stop arresting people for low-level crimes if a ticket can be issued instead. And that is going on all across the country here in the Bay Area. Arrests and jailings have dropped sharply. And one of the things that I'm concerned about, because I generally do support the release of prisoners so that we don't turn our jails and prisons into transmission zones, but a lot of the people who get released may not have a place to go. And maybe they get a couple of hundred bucks when they're dropped off at a bus stop. The other thing I want to note is that Gavin Newsom has come a long way, baby. Gavin Newsom was the product of the Willie Brown machine. When Brown was the mayor of San Francisco, he first appointed Newsom to a parking commission, then appointed him to the Board of Supervisors, where Newsom then won election in his own right and later ran for mayor. And he annoyed a lot of us progressives because his signature campaign theme when he ran for mayor was called Care Not Cash. He felt that too many homeless people received welfare checks and spent them on drugs and booze, and so he wanted to remove the cash component. And he championed a process where they converted those cash payments to vouchers for single-room occupancy hotels. And it was seen as quite cruel, because, of course, not every welfare recipient blows their check on drugs and booze. But his response, I think, is really remarkable under these circumstances. He's got $1 billion that's already been approved by the legislature. He started to spend it buying up blocks of hotel rooms, and the hotels need the business. These hotels are being converted into homeless accommodations, hoping to reduce the transmission by getting people off the streets. This is care with a lot of cash. And I give Gavin Newsom high marks for the growth that he has shown as a political leader. He also announced that they have leased a hospital, one just south of San Francisco, and he said they'll announce shortly one near Los Angeles. The hospital ship Mercy is due to arrive in Los Angeles sometime in the next week. And the one thing we haven't seen so far that is occurring in Washington State is the creation of, short-term facilities to house people who either there isn't room in the hospitals for or they don't quite qualify for it as they either go through a quarantine or treatment after contracting the coronavirus. So we have a hell of a lot of unemployed people, and the Trump administration response is to suppress the data. They have ordered state officials not to release information about the number of claims that have been filed. They're all to be collected by the federal government, and on Thursdays, they're going to report to us on how many fellow Americans have been sidelined because of all of these shutdowns. And this is, again, Trump trying to manage his reputation, manage his electability at the expense of human beings. And once again, the Federal Reserve is pumping money into the economy, now into short-term municipal bonds. And as we'll discuss in a moment, the priority here is the economy and corporate America. There also is a big scandal emerging. Initially, the reports indicated that Richard Burr, the Republican from North Carolina, who is chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, sold hundreds of thousands of dollars in stocks right at the peak of the market and just before the crash caused by knowledge of the spreading coronavirus. We'll go into more detail on that in a moment. On the pharmaceutical front, yesterday Trump misrepresented the status of remdesivir and chloroquine as approved treatments for coronavirus. They are thought to have some potential. But it was one of the first times when Tony Fauci, playing a wax figure behind Trump at a news conference, actually spoke up to correct the president. Oh, we know Trump can't handle that, but it's about time somebody did. Now, one of the figures that has been bandied about in the collection of data about the coronavirus is that children don't get it. Well, last night I was surprised because on a local newscast on television, they reported the current breakdown, the age breakdown, of the cases that have been identified in California so far. And you wouldn't be surprised that there are 448 in California between the ages of 18 and 64, 209 over age 65. But they reported 13 cases. Now, that's a small number. But of individuals under age 17. And those college students who are partying on the beaches in Florida, they've been ordered to get off the sand. But I believe many of them heard that, it only is killing old people, so who cares? And Linda dug up more data. In China, the coronavirus did kill a 10-month-old with pre-existing health conditions. More than 4.4% of the children in a pediatrics report were without evident symptoms. An additional 51 had mild symptoms, such as cough, sore throat, runny nose, that sort of thing. The remaining 39% of children were moderately ill. So it does seem to be fair that children end up with a milder impact if they contract the coronavirus. But billionaire bad boy Elon Musk, who we were talking snark about yesterday because he has fought the closure of his Tesla assembly line in Fremont, California. Well, earlier this week, Twitter tightened its rules and said that it would take down posts and punish people who posted misinformation about the coronavirus. But that didn't stop Musk, and Twitter has not punished him or, taken the post down in any way. He put up a tweet yesterday that children are essentially immune. Kids are essentially immune, but elderly with existing conditions are vulnerable. Now, similar to Trump, his tune has changed over time, where he was saying, don't worry about it, let's keep making electric cars. So, on Monday, Twitter's policy was amended, and get this, they used the example of misinformation about children and the virus as a specific example of a violation of its new policies. But we're also told that Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey thinks that Elon Musk is one of the world-class tweeters on his platform. And like Trump, The rules do not apply. Linda Lewis also notes that the urban-rural medical divide could leave people outside urban areas at greater risk. More than half the counties in America have no intensive care beds. 18 million people live in counties that have hospitals but no ICU. About a quarter of them are 60 or older, the analysis shows. 11 million more Americans reside in counties with no hospital, and that's including about 2.7 million seniors in those counties. And even the counties that rank in the top 10% for ICU bed count still have as many as 450 older people potentially competing for each single bed in their facilities. So Trump announced today that there is a formal extension of the tax filing deadline, not just the payments, to July 15th. And I've been spending most of my evenings compiling all my tax information to hand off to my CPA. And he's pretty relaxed now. Usually at this time, he's saying, you know, when can you get this to me? I got 100 returns to file. So that is a relief to many people. Also, Bernie Sanders, take a bow. Trump announced deferment of student loan payments for the next 60 days. Let's see what else is going on here. We mentioned the travel advisory, that no one is immune. Male mortality seems to be twice that of females. Trump said that when he was asked about the possibility of a national lockdown, I don't think so. And Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, said there is no bar on humanitarian and medical assistance to Iran. Well, that comes as news to me, and it's welcome news. I'd like to see a picture of Mike Pompeo standing next to that cargo plane, loaded with humanitarian assistance and on its way to Tehran. And then I might believe it. And I got to tell you this, Rush Limbaugh, as you know, has stage 4 cancer, and he's infrequently hosting his radio show. And I don't know the name of the right-wing sub who was on for him today, but he was gushing about how Trump's response has been magnificent. This is the CEO at his best, solving problems. And his compliments were mostly based on the fact that, inexplicably, the polling showed a bounce. I shared it with you a couple of days ago, the Ipsos poll, Reuters Ipsos, that Trump had lost about 8 points in favorability related to the coronavirus episode, and it came back. Oh, the MAGA morons. I'll tell you a quick story. Last night we were texting back and forth with cousin Don in Detroit, who's gone to the dark side. He's a Trumper. And he was, you know, honest about the risk. But when we asked him if he's ready to give up on Trump, he said, no way. I want to nuke China. And Don, you know, in many respects, you're a great guy. But that's just such programmed thinking. You hear Trump repeatedly in a racist manner call it the Chinese virus. You want to blame China? We don't really know. As I explored yesterday, there are many valid theories to be pursued about where this virus came from and how it was either released or contracted. And the idea that we would nuke China is, well, it's very Trumpian. I want to thank Colleen McGuire, a longtime listener, who shared a Bloomberg News report and a similar report from the Agenzia Nova in Italy. And this does not fit in with the bigger picture that we've been receiving. but I want to share it with you for your consideration. The Bloomberg story reads, more than 99% of Italy's coronavirus fatalities were people who suffered from previous medical conditions, according to a study by the country's National Health Authority. After deaths from the virus hit the 2,500 mark, so that's about a week ago, authorities have been combing through data. They're evaluating whether to extend their national lockdown. But the study, while showing a death rate of 8% of totally infected people, they are saying that most of those people had existing, pre-existing health conditions that compromised them. And the Rome-based institute has only examined about 18% of the medical records so far, so this is a preliminary finding. They found that, now this is mixing percentages and numbers, so this makes it difficult to make a fair comparison, particularly in your head as you're just listening to me describe these numbers. So they've examined 18% of the coronavirus fatalities, finding that just three victims out of that 18%, or 0.8% of the total, had no previous pathology. Almost half of the victims suffered from at least three prior illnesses. About a fourth had one or two previous conditions. More than 75% had high blood pressure, 35% diabetes. A third suffered from heart disease. So I want to be clear, these are preliminary figures, and we're unable to get to the source here and look at the full data set. But I think you deserve to know what is being reported. Big scandal brewing in Washington. I think we should put Martha Stewart in charge of the new investigation into insider trading by members of the United States Senate. And I haven't seen the numbers lately, but well over half of the members of the Senate are millionaires. Some of them have massive wealth in the tens or hundreds of millions of dollars. And Richard Burr, who chairs the Intelligence Committee, Republican from North Carolina, he is the central figure right now under consideration for entry into the Senate Insider Trading Hall of Fame. Because he was privy, he was briefed, he sits on intelligence and on a health committee, and so he was routinely getting information about the looming threat of the coronavirus. And just before the market tanked and took you and me from a feeling of prosperity into a sense of loss and dread about our 401ks or retirement stock market accounts, well, Richard Burr sold between, and we get these ranges because of the vague reports that they file with the Senate Ethics Office. But it was somewhere between $300,000 and $1.6 million that the senator unloaded. And it included stocks in hotels, hospitality industry is what they call it, which have been hammered by the lack of customers at hotels, and many hotels have had to shut down. And then the woman who is described as the wealthiest, a recently appointed senator from Georgia, Republican Kelly Loeffler or Leffler, her husband is the chairman of the New York Stock Exchange. They got bundles of money. And in her accounts, they traded between $1.2 and $3.1 million. And she sold shares the same day as a briefing she received and bought between $100,000 and $250,000 in Citrix, a technology company that offers teleworking software. One of the stocks that has done well in the turbulence of the market. Now, Richard Burr says he didn't do anything wrong, that he relied on public information that he got from CNBC. Was he listening to Jimmy Cramer shout at him? Now, that's absurd. And this is the kind of parallel construction that we get from people who are invested in control of our nation's secrets. They'll tell you, well, you know, that's a top secret. I can't tell you that. But, you know, I saw a report in the National Enquirer and blah, blah, blah. And for Loeffler's account, she said that she doesn't have any control, that multiple third-party advisors, not her or her husband, made the decisions to sell shares in January and February. Similarly, California's very senior senator and a Democrat, the only one implicated here, Dianne Feinstein, says that I don't manage my accounts. And so she is acting as if she had nothing to do with it. But we know that there are ways that people send messages to the advisor of a blind trust. Can happen over coffee. Can happen at a fundraiser. And you can nod and wink and bob and weave. But the optics of this, as a nation hunkers down and many people will lose income, they will burn through whatever savings they may have. They may wind up being evicted eventually or being foreclosed on. And some of them are going to die. And members of the Millionaires Club in the United States Senate are cashing in. This serves up the message of Bernie Sanders in sharp relief. The idiocy of our system, it is an oligarchy. It's out there to protect the interests of the already wealthy, the already powerful. And we are on our own. So this morning, Burr said that he is asking the Senate Ethics Committee to investigate his ethics. And first, they'll have to find out if he has any. So with that backdrop, these millionaires are debating how to help out, first of all, corporate America. And secondly, well, let me put it this way. They're trying to figure out the sweet spot. How much in bailouts, handouts, and loans can we give to corporate America? How little can we give to every American and get away with it? And be seen as generous and compassionate? And we know the bottom line for Trump is the numbers, because he doesn't want to look bad, and how this treats his own fortunes and his cronies. And whatever trickles down to the rest of us, you know, that'll be okay. And they'll massage that and spin it up and tweet about it. Trump has already rewritten his bungled response into something as perfect as the Ukraine phone call. And I'm just going to briefly tell you that they have reached no consensus. The Republicans are thinking about maybe one check of $1,200, maybe two checks of $1,200. But the way it's structured in the Republican proposal coming from good old Mitch McConnell is just absurd. It is regressive. Because the people who earn the least need money the most. But they're offering a progressive handout to individuals. So that if you made $100,000 last year, you're going to get more than somebody who made $50,000. Now, I recognize that there are people who make $100,000, even $200,000, $300,000 a year who are over-leveraged and they got a huge credit card debt and a lifestyle that they want to maintain. But we've got to start at the poverty level. Then we got to move up to the working class level. And these people need to be able to pay the rent and, as good old George W. Bush said, put food on their families. And it really is obscene that the prevailing mentality there among the Republicans is really just tokenism. And so I'm shocked to report that Josh Hawley, Republican senator and a freshman from Missouri, he's the one who knocked out Claire McCaskill. Relief to families in this emergency shouldn't be regressive. Lower income families shouldn't be penalized. Even Lindsey Graham is saying, well, what I want is income, not one check. I want to get a check you can count on every week, not just one week. So we will see how that plays out. And just at my deadline, Linda Lewis sent me a link to a column that I had missed at the Washington Post. Jennifer Rubin, the opinion columnist who's been regularly bashing Bernie Sanders, took the day off from that. And while she loathes Tucker Carlson, like many of us do, he is one of the people who has been most outspoken about Richard Burr and his perceived profiteering. And he went on his show and said, there is no greater moral crime than betraying your country in a time of crisis. This appears to be what happened. And Rubin says, there are two moral offenses here. One is concealing the magnitude of the crisis, and the other is profiting from it. And she raises the legitimate question, did Trump play down the crisis in his tweets and his public comments and in his slow response in order to prop up the market so his friends could cash out before the predictable crash hit? Now, these are questions, and they deserve an investigation. And that's why I'm proposing putting Martha Stewart in charge of it. She's been there. She did time in a federal prison, wore an ankle bracelet that did not coordinate with her other accessories. And I think it'd be a really pretty kind of payback to have her preside over that. Opportunistically taking advantage of the crisis, Stephen Miller and the xenophobic crowd of the White House are using this moment to virtually shut down all human traffic across the southern border. Immigrants trying to enter illegally will be immediately thrown back over the border like small fish. And the asylum system is being further eviscerated in deep violation of American law. Even in the Constitution, there is a provision for asylum. The New York Times is confirming that last year there were what we could call war games, simulations of a crisis, of a pandemic caused by a virus coming from China. 47 days into it, 110 million Americans were expected to become ill, 7 million hospitalized, 500,000 dead. It was codenamed Crimson Contagion, and it was a long-planned effort that ran from January to August of 2019. Then they wrote a report in October, and nothing happened. And we are as ill-prepared as if those simulations had never been held. With the smell of free money, smells like pork. It's all over, wafting all over Washington. And the lobbyists and the greedsters are on the hunt. The restaurant industry has requested $325 billion, Boeing wants $60 billion, travel industry $250 billion, manufacturers $1.4 trillion. The movers, is that moving industry? $187 million to make up for lost revenue? Yeah, it is the moving industry because the Defense Department has halted moves. Airbnb wants tax breaks and access to small business loans to people who lost income from a decline in home rentals. Then there are the pig farmers. Yeah, they want their pork. Renewing their call for the feds to expedite foreign worker visas. So this is a feeding frenzy. And we have to be prepared to be fleeced. It's going to happen. They're going to slip into must-pass legislation, things that have absolutely nothing to do with the human impact of coronavirus. And Craig Holman, a great guy who I've interviewed several times over at Public Citizen, he says many of the industries that the Trump administration is ready to bail out, airlines, cruise lines, hotels, don't need or deserve the help. Quote, these industries already have access to cash reserves from their wealthy investors. And these large corporations have a very poor track record when it comes to spending bailout funds, using much of the money to preserve profits for shareholders, stock buybacks that pay higher bonuses to executives, and so on. Interesting piece published at the Times today by Robert Salden and Stephen Tellis, the authors of a book coming out called Never Trump, The Revolt of the Conservative Elites. And this is kind of a I-told-you-so situation. The first guy they quote is the odious racist Charles Murray, who they euphemize as a controversial conservative social scientist. And way back last summer, he said you can't have a successful limited government unless you have a population that is itself virtuous. And so that means character in the leaders is important, not just so they can perform a job effectively. It's extremely important as an emblem of what the country's all about. Then there's Peter Weiner, who is now an op-ed writer for the New York Times. And he's a longstanding never-Trumper. There are just too many things in the presidency that you can't anticipate. You ultimately have to depend on the wisdom and prudence, the insight of an individual, and Trump strikes me as somebody with a disordered personality. I think he's emotionally and psychologically unstable and temperamentally dangerous. Then there's Peter Feaver. He was an apologist for George W. Bush, and he still teaches poli-sci at Duke. He said, Trump personified the problems of 2012. He's referring to Sarah Palin. Outrageous statements, not well-briefed, a stance of anti-expertise, as if knowing something about the policy, having experience, was a bad thing. Trump was personifying that, doubling down on it, tripling down on it. And in a separate report, we learned that the Trump campaign has been frequently communicating with its loyalists, and only once has mentioned the coronavirus in order to blame it on Democrats. This is a Times article, too. The gap between the Trump campaign's boosterism and the unsettling reality of a nation under siege can be jarring. Even it goes as it goes, unseen by most Americans, unless they are among the millions who've opted to receive Trump's online campaign missives. Here's one from last Friday, the same day that schools were closed, sporting events canceled, and Trump declared a national emergency. You'll never hear it from the lamestream media and their Democratic partners, but America is winning like never before. Doesn't that make you feel great? Every day I pause to share my winning with the great people who subscribe to this podcast and help support my work, including the trusty Carl Howard in Columbus, Ohio, my office neighbor, David Brown, who's now a monthly subscriber and is also promoting the podcast to his friends and family, and good old Dick Attlee, who is retired in Maine and a frequent correspondent here, and I always appreciate his contributions. Now, one of the things that we've been talking about this week is that Trump apparently was pressured into invoking the Defense Protection Act that gives the president powers to force American industries to produce whatever is needed at a critical time. So Trump has said that he has activated it, but it appears that there are advisors in the White House adhering to longstanding conservative opposition to big government. That goes back to Reagan's pronunciation of government. And so they're trying to prevent Trump from activating, actually implementing this power. And Trump deflects it to governors. He said they should be lining up their own face masks and protective gear and ventilators and respirators. He said, you know, we're not a shipping clerk. I mean, that is just so aggravating. Fundamentally, these are the moments when government is supposed to be there to protect the population. And this kind of rationalization, this hewing to bizarre conservative philosophies as a way of explaining inaction is just totally unacceptable. Bill de Blasio, New York mayor, quote, "We're talking about a president who's basically doing what Herbert Hoover did at the beginning of the Depression, minimizing the danger, refusing to use available federal action, and people are going to die, and they shouldn't. They don't have to if we could get the support that we're asking for." And even a Republican governor from South Dakota, Kristi Noem, was on a conference call with Trump. She got frustrated expressing to the president the runaround she's been getting. She said, "I need to understand how you're triaging supplies. For 2 weeks, we were requesting reagents for our public health lab from CDC. They pushed us to private suppliers who kept canceling orders on us. And we keep making requests, placing orders." She said, "I don't want to be less of a priority because we are a smaller or less populated state." And Trump assured her that would never happen, just as the governor of South Dakota's phone line was disconnected. I didn't make that up. I can't. All right. How about something a little uplifting? Larry Brilliant is a man who lives up to his surname. I've been in a small room hearing him speak, and he really single-handedly led a worldwide effort to wipe out smallpox, going door to door in India to give people vaccinations. He's also fought flu, polio, blindness. At one point, he ran the foundation at Google, giving away money. He's also a deadhead, and he's just a very smart and cool guy. He is the chairman now of Ending Pandemics. And I want to recommend the interview conducted by Stephen Levy, who's a great journalist who's covered Silicon Valley and technology for a long time. It appears at Wired. I'll just lift a couple of quickies here. Dr. Brilliant says this is the most dangerous pandemic in his lifetime. As a public health person, Trump's failed reaction is the most irresponsible act of an elected official that he has ever witnessed. And let me read this part. He says, eventually, in 12 to 18 months, we will get to the epidemiologist gold ring. Levy, what's that? Brilliant. That means, A, a large enough quantity of us have caught the disease and become immune, and B, we have a vaccine. The combination of A plus B is enough to create herd immunity, which is around 70 or 80%. I hold out hope that we can get an antiviral for COVID-19 that is curative, but in addition is prophylactic. It's that, you know what that means, right? It's certainly unproven, and it's certainly controversial, and certainly a lot of people are not going to agree with me. But I offer evidence, two papers, 2005, one in Nature and one in Science. They both did mathematical modeling with influenza to see whether saturation with just Tamiflu in one area around a case of influenza could stop the outbreak. And in both cases, it worked. So there's more in the interview. I've linked to it in the show file. Check it out. And you can read it with all the extra spare time you have these days. You also might want to spend some time with my buddy Jeff Schechtman, my colleague over at Who, What, Why. He's posted a podcast interview with writer Matt Richtel, who wrote the book about the human immune system, An Elegant Defense. I think that sounds worthy. Meanwhile, the New York Times, continuing its Russophobia, has an article that goes on in great lengths about the reaction in Russia. They have performed 133,000 tests there already. And they're backing up stay-at-home orders with deep surveillance. They have 9,000 cameras in Moscow alone, Oh, well, let me get this. I'm sorry, I got that wrong. They have 178,000 that are deployed. And it's not clear if that's only in Moscow, but this is a quote or an attribution of Moscow's top police official. They're adding 9,000 cameras for a total of almost 190,000. And they use them. They give us an example of a man named Artyom, no last name please, age 30. He left his apartment building to take out the trash 2 days after receiving a quarantine order because he had been traveling in Italy. 2 days later, police officers came to his house with an official police report, a printout showing his passport photo, alongside his image taken by a surveillance camera. And he has a date in a court in Moscow and will likely be fined. Similar surveillance tactics are producing protests in Israel. I've reported twice this week on how the Netanyahu government is using location data from cell phones that they were secretly collecting to try to identify outbreaks of infection. And this is coupled with Netanyahu's move to shut down the courts the day before he was supposed to go on trial on 3 corruption cases. Oh, nothing insidious about that. And he also ordered the Internal Security Agency, Shin Bet, to use a secret database of citizen cell phone data to track down people who may have come into contact with carriers of the virus. The Gray Zone has an excellent report by my friend, journalist and historian Gareth Porter, that recaps the collusion between Netanyahu and Trump's Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo, in their desperation to trigger a war with Iran. It's an excellent read. I recommend it to you. Also at Gray Zone, Ben Norton, also covering Pompeo, reveals his recent threats to not only the people who work at the International Criminal Court, but their family members. And this is because the ICC is continuing to pursue investigations of war crimes in Afghanistan committed by American forces. Now, we only refer other nations to the court. We've never signed on to the treaty, and therefore we claim that it doesn't have jurisdiction over Americans. And Pompeo calls it a so-called court, a nakedly political body, an embarrassment. We want to identify those responsible for this partisan investigation and their family members who may want to travel to the United States or engage in activity that's inconsistent with making sure we protect Americans. This is a rationalization for obstruction of justice and for collective punishment. And it's a violation of international treaties. Somebody ought to tell Pompeo. Robert Mackey at The Intercept does a great job of following up on something we mentioned yesterday at the Trump news conference. There was this woman throwing softball questions. Her name is Chanel Ryan. I think it's pronounced that way, R-I-O-N. And she is a movement Republican. She's married to an extreme Republican who ran for the Senate. She recently went to Ukraine to capture Rudy Giuliani's propaganda. And I saw her reports on the One America News Network. Not only badly produced, but it's not journalism in any way. She simply enabled Rudy Giuliani to spew whatever he wanted to say. And in his report, Mackey cites James Fallows, a respected journalist who once worked in the White House, and he suggests that the cable outlet should stop covering Trump's news conferences. He said, without live coverage, Trump will stop showing up. Scientists can speak. I think that's a good idea. So if you want to know more about that, follow the link in the show file to The Intercept for Mackey's report. Mike Bloomberg made some big promises when he was trying to buy the White House. And you know he dropped more than $500 million in his truncated campaign. As he exited, he promised to pay all of his campaign people to support the eventual nominee all the way to November, to keep the leases on the campaign offices that he had set up around the country. But he was lying. Bloomberg is abandoning plans to form a new super PAC for the presidential race, to pay his field organizers through November. Instead, he's just handing off his operation and $18 million to the Democratic National Committee. He is inviting his former staffers to apply for work at the DNC and suggested that some of them might get hired, but they won't get the same cushy pay that he was giving them. I continue to cringe just at the way so many people, particularly diehard Democrats, were drawn to Mike Bloomberg because he's rich and he's authoritarian. And somehow they thought he was the Messiah who's going to rescue us from Trump. And finally today, I was really pleasantly tickled to read in the New York Times today a lovely obituary to my friend Mal Sharpe. And I've talked about him over the past week or so. He died over a week ago. I've linked to it, and I hope you'll check it out, in memory of one of the coolest guys who I have ever known and worked with. Thanks for listening to this news and comment podcast. You can share it all over the place. You'll find it on YouTube. I remain Peter B. Collins.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails.